I'm sure there's some financial problems in this particular company, so I'm sure that's what it's about. So
we just learned that yesterday.
I just got that yesterday afternoon, and so I need to be on that conference call at 9 o'clock.
We Tom and I think had told everybody 8 to 10, and so I don't know if there's how long that's going to last, if we take a timeout, or how we do that.
Well, let's see how it goes, okay. And if you feel that we need to, you know, reconvene later or something like that.
Another date if it's necessary. Yeah.
Okay.
But
sounds good.
You know, I don't want people to be cut off or to feel, you know.
Well, and we're having another meeting tomorrow. Some of you may know from two to whenever tomorrow. So perhaps, and I think they were more scheduled to be here than tomorrow. So
yeah,
perhaps
right.
If some people wanted to return and didn't have some questions answered, maybe that might work too.
That would be great.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I want to thank Tom and Chuck and all of you for coming, and I appreciate the opportunity. You know, I have just recently, I guess a week ago Friday, met with the people at Des Moines University and announced my retirement. It was a tough decision because for the last 6 years and 2 months I've been the president of Des Moines University, and it's been a great experience. We have grown from 1,200 to 1,800 students. We're a university that prepares physicians and also podiatrists, and then we have a College of Health Sciences where we have a doctor for physical therapy, a master's for physicians assistants, and master's in public health and healthcare administration. All the students are graduate students, are all going into some kind of a healthcare type career. And I got acquainted with the school when I was governor because I discovered they were preparing more of the doctors and more of the healthcare professionals that served in the state of Iowa than the University of Iowa with the state school. And in fact, there are alumni of Des Moines University in 94 of the 99 counties of Iowa, and we have alumni in all 50 states, and we get students, a lot of them from rural areas, and there's a shortage of doctors in rural areas, so that's, we're meeting a real need, and it was really an enjoyable experience, and we were able to build a real strong team there. While I was there, of course, my wife had gone to St. Joseph Academy, and one of the first things we did, I kind of joked about this, in 1972, Chris and I got married, and I ran for and got elected to the legislature. In 73, we came to see what the then College of Osteopathic Medicine had purchased St. Joseph Academy and what they were going to do with my wife's old high school, especially the chapel, and lo and behold, 30 years later, I become the president, and the first thing we do is tore down our high school. But it was structurally obsolete. We replaced it with this brand new student education center, and in fact, we adjust in October 1st received the what's called the Wellness Council of America. They give awards to companies that do things for wellness for their employees. We were the first college or university to get the platinum level award from the Wellness Council of America. I think there's 16 companies in Des Moines University that have received that award. So I'm really proud of that achievement. We also increased enrollment from 1,200 to 1,800 while I was the president, increased the endowment from 55 million to 80 million. I tell you that because it's a job that I really loved and enjoyed. But I also, I guess spent 26 years of my life in public service in the state of Iowa, 16 as governor, and I've been watching what's been going on in state government, and I've been very disturbed about what I've been seeing and felt that there's really a need for change. And I believe that both the experience that I've had previously in government and the experience I've had at Des Moines University has prepared me to be the one to help the state make the tough decisions and get the state fiscal house in order and restore stability and responsibility to leadership in state government. I was going to say I'm a lifelong conservative, but that probably wouldn't be true because my family were Democrats, although I think they were pretty conservative Democrats. I read Barry Goldwater's Conscience of a Conservative in high school and convinced that I was a conservative and worked for Goldwater in 64. Actually went to the Mid-City Airport with a sign that said Democrats for Goldwater. and then went to the University of Iowa in the 60s, which was a very liberal place. Was involved at the University of Iowa in both the Young Americans for Freedom and Campus Crusade for Christ. I also became the, and it might be my phone. I'm sorry to be on disturbing the meeting. So while there, I got actively involved in, and actually was part of the conservatives taking control of the University of Iowa College Republican Club back in about 1968. I then was a Vietnam era draftee, spent 2 years in the Army, came back and went to Drake High School, and I was part of the conservatives taking over then the Drake College Republican Club, was the vice chairman of that. So I've been involved in the conservative movement, I guess, for a long period of time, and actually ran for the legislature when I was still in law school. Worked my law school between legislative sessions and practiced law in Lake Mills while I served in the legislature as lieutenant governor, and then had the honor of serving the people of Iowa for 16 years as governor. Now, during most of that time, liberal Democrats were in control of both houses of the legislature. If you remember, and some of you may be too young to remember this, but I was elected in 1982, which was kind of the onset of the farm crisis, but it was also a time of recession. The unemployment rate nationally in 1982 was higher than it is today. It was over 10%. It was 8.3% in Iowa when I took office. In the first 4 years that I was governor, we closed 38 banks and land values dropped 63%. It was a very stressful and difficult time. And the first decade, the first 10 years that I was governor, Democrats controlled both houses of legislature. So I had a really pitched battle on most things during that period of time. And finally then, in 1991, and I did in that process beat two Democratic legislative leaders who wanted the governor's job, first Lowell Junkins and then Don Avenson. And then in 91, we went through a battle with the public employee unions in which the state was in a recession, as it is now, and we had an outside arbitrator impose a salary increase of 9 to 19% on us. We couldn't afford it. I vetoed it. The unions took it to court. The Supreme Court ruled against us. Unanimous decision. Imposed, which I couldn't believe, because I thought the governor has the power to veto, and if you veto it and it's not overturned by the legislature, then it should stand. So that was imposed on us. Then I had no choice and had to go and have significant layoffs. But I didn't stop there. I then appointed a committee called the Committee to Reform State Spending. And that's exactly what I think needs to be done now. This was a bipartisan group, although the Democrats I appointed were conservatives, people like Dolores Mertz. But was chaired by David Fisher, and we said no sacred cows, basically look at everything and come up with ways that we can reduce spending and take spending off autopilot and get the state budget, which had never been balanced on generally accepted accounting principles for public entities, balanced on generally accepted accounting principles for public entities. And they put together a 10-point plan. I submitted that to the legislature then in 92. Democrats still in control of both houses. We got 5 of the 10 approved. I had been invited to the Kentucky Derby, the one and only time I've ever been to the Kentucky Derby, by the governor of Kentucky. So we were there at the Kentucky Derby, the only time I was ever there, and lo and behold, they passed a sales tax increase and adjourned while I was gone. I came back and I said, you didn't pass all the spending reforms. If you don't pass the rest of them, I'm going to veto the sales tax. I brought them back. There's a 30-day window between when the legislature adjourns and when the governor has to sign her veto bills. I brought them back, and they passed part of one of the additional spending reforms. They passed about five of them. They passed part of one of the others, and they adjourned at midnight. I got out of bed, drove across town. Well, a trooper brought me, and I went to the Capitol, and at midnight, or 12:30, whatever time it was, middle of the night, I vetoed the sales tax. I said, this time I'm not bringing you back until we have an agreement to pass the rest of the spending reforms. And we then negotiated for about 2 months, or whatever it was. This was, I think, in late April or early May, till latter part of June, till we finally reached an agreement. We cut another $70 million out of the budget, and we got all the rest of the spending reforms. The tenth item was the Taxpayers' Rights Amendment. And we could get that through one house, but not the other. So I finally agreed, if they did all of the, pass the rest of those spending reforms, that I would accept the sales tax as part of it. It was passed, and the agreement was it had to be passed by both houses of the legislature and a majority of both parties voting for it, which they did. The goal was to get the budget balanced on generally accepted accounting principles within 3 years to establish the cash reserve and economic emergency account and have these safeguards that would to prevent spending from being out of control. Basically, it worked. Also, key thing is, 1992 Republicans gained majority in the House of Representatives for the first time in a decade. And then we had Ron Corbett to stop. And Chuck, I think maybe that's about the time you came to the legislature, isn't it?
Yeah, I came in 90, 2 years in the minority, and then 4 years in the majority.
So you were there during that kind of era to remember what happened. And so then what we did is, and we literally, I was able to keep Medicaid under control, and basically we filled the cash reserve in 2 years. We met our goal, a three-year goal in 2 years, and then we got Republican control of the Senate in 96, and that's when we then eliminated the inheritance tax for lineal descendants, cut the income tax 10%. I tried to get 15, couldn't get that through the Senate, but we did cut it 10% across the board for everybody. So I left office with a $900 million surplus after those tax cuts. And now we have a projected $1 billion deficit. And what really concerns me is this governor, his philosophy is we're going to grow the economy by growing government. And I believe it's just the opposite. We need to reduce the size of government, reduce the tax burden to grow private sector opportunities. And that so this last session, you know what happened. One time, federal stimulus money was used, a significant amount of it, for ongoing expenses like school aid and Medicaid. And then they went out and borrowed $830 million on top of that, which has to be paid back with interest. To me, I think that's exactly the wrong direction. And it really is mortgaging the future. It's following the direction the federal government is going, which I think is racking up huge, huge debt to be paid back by our children. So, and that's what I guess really concerns me. And then I think I should also address the Supreme Court decision. I told you what happened to me on the issue of the veto. I learn as a lawyer, if you can settle a case, don't go to court, because you never know what's going to happen. And I guess I was, like most Iowans, really shocked to see what our Supreme Court did. And I believe it needs to be overturned with a constitutional amendment. I support a constitutional amendment. But I think that's the only way that you're really going to be able to overturn the court decision on same-sex marriage. Yeah, John.
Governor Branstad, and under your administration, the flow chart clearly was reduced for state government. I guess the first thing I would ask is, do you have a a specific plan that you've prepared on how to fix and repair state government? And if so, where can we find that?
Okay, well, I can show you, and in fact, I think David Fisher and Gretchen Tegeler are going to do an opinion piece on the what I call the Committee to Reform State Spending, which became known as the Fisher Commission. But if you go back and look at that plan, I think it was a very well-developed plan, and it worked.
I mean, for now.
Now, I think we got to go further, and I think we got to look at local government as well as state government. But I think the process we went through then makes sense. We need to put together a group, and we need to look at, and that what I'm doing, and this is just the first of many meetings like this I'm going to put together around the state. I'm going to go out and reach out to people and ask for your ideas, how we can do this, and then to try to develop a consensus. And I want to get people that have experience. I've talked to people like Randy Feenstra, who's worked for the city of Hull, for the county government in Sioux County, and now as a state senator. I want to get people like that that have experience in local government and state government, as well as people from the private sector, to put together a plan to deal with this. Well, I think it's going to take a comprehensive approach.
But the governor, the reason I ask that, so you're developing the plan, but the reason I ask that, because you were governor for 16 years, and in the absence of an existing plan, we have to also look at the record. When we look, for example, at the state government flowchart, we find law enforcement academy, corrections, public safety, public defense. Then we go over to human rights and we find criminal juvenile justice, and we look in inspection and appeals, we find public defender. And while there's no question, and I've said this publicly, that there's no question that you are infinitely more competent than the current administration, those aspects of state government were never repaired. Also,
When you say it weren't repaired, let me just go back. In 1986,
flowchart was reduced, but we went from
like 64 agencies to 25 agencies. The one that we weren't able to get done as a commission for the blind because the legislature just couldn't take the heat from the tap 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 of the white canes. But we did go from like 64 to 25.
Well, actually, it was more than 64, but there was a significant reduction in the flow chart. The actual size of government and spending continued to grow. But the reason I ask that is because what didn't occur was the surgical repair of state government, so that we find a lot of orphan bureaucracies in places that cost us administration. DHS reform, which, you know, DHS is the elephant in the jungle. Yeah. It's not the lion. Education's the lion. We didn't see that tackled. So you mentioned that you had a Democratic legislature, and during that time taxes were raised. With Grostel and Murphy in charge of the legislature, how do you effectively implement reform? The second thing is, and I think most people in this room would agree, the Iowa State Education Association is an unparalleled problem in public education. Now during your administration, while we did see things happen like the Norway School District close, we also saw things like North High School start 312 students in the freshman class of 91 and only graduate 160 students. Those are the same numbers that have taken place under Vilsack and Culver. So when we look at education, particularly now that urban education has 28 of the 29 high schools failing, what are the specific differences in how you would fix education, considering that the numbers then, and the big, I think one of the big advantages your administration had is I wasn't telling people what the real numbers were, but we were still seeing at schools like North High School only 50 to 55% of the students move on to the senior class. So how do we fix education considering the role the ISEA was able to establish during that administration? And finally, there are some core issues, not just social, but I think foundational. For example, gambling, not just the moral implication, but the economic consequences and the devastation that's wrecked in communities like mine. Plus, there are issues like under your administration, and I don't know if this is a question where you weren't aware or you were aware, but we also saw significant changes like DHS beginning to be able or allowing homosexual couples to adopt children. Now, were you aware of that? Was it something that occurred without your awareness? And I guess the answer is important because it I think helps